Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, the dearly departed and greatly missed Pete Seeger, along with David Burns, with the Rivertown Kids. That was on the Tomorrow's Children, is on the Tomorrow's Children album, and won a Grammy, by God. It won a Grammy, and it's the opener of our show, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're happy to have you with us today, and we have an astonishing guest today. We're going to have him with us for the full hour, Dr. George Sackheim, speaking to us from the hills of Pennsylvania. Dr. Sackheim, are you with us? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well.
Good, good. Well, I can hear you very well. So you are a rare and unique guest for our show today. But since we talk about the health of the planet and the need of human beings to survive and to thrive and to treat each other with decency, I'm going to tell a little bit of your story. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I've read much of your paperwork and we have talked. You are an exceedingly gracious, cordial and kind person, and Dr. Sackheim is 91 years old and was born in Germany and has an astonishing history, which much of which I'm going to let him tell you because it's better for you to hear from directly from him. But Dr. Sackheim is probably the only person I or any of my listeners will ever meet who was an interpreter at the Nuremberg trials following World War II, when many of the prominent Nazis were put on trial for their crimes against humanity. Dr. Sackheim was there in person. I have seen the pictures and have read some of the accounts. It's an astonishing story. I met Dr. Sackheim over the phone, thanks to some contact with his daughter, Ruthie, who is a great grassroots organizer in California. And when she just mentioned casually her father's history, I just knew I had to have him on the Solartopia show. Dr. Sackheim, can you tell us, for start, we are going to get to your experiences as an interpreter with the Nazis. We also, with the Nuremberg trials, we also want to go beyond that and talk to you. You were an interrogator of World War II prisoners, many of them Nazis, many of them just members of the German army, and have some important things to say about our current policies on how we treat prisoners and extract information from them, and that will be towards the end of the show. But to give the full depth of our experience and your experience with you, our experience with you and your experiences in life, tell us, please, Dr. Sackheim, and you are a doctor of psychology and have been in practice both institutionally and in private practice as a psychologist for many, many years. You also did some very interesting research on children who start fires, and hopefully if we can have some time, we're going to get to that. But Dr. Sackheim, if you give us a bit of your personal history, you have done public presentations and you do have a DVD somewhere on the internet, but tell us, please, where you were born and what led to this amazing career of yours.
Sure. I was born in Hamburg, Germany, in June 1923, and my father at the time was a director of the municipal theater in Hamburg, and my mother stayed at home taking care of me. I was an only child, and the first 3 years we spent in Hamburg, And then my father was offered a better opportunity to become in German it's called Dramaturg, but in English it's sort of the artistic director of the theater. He was not the business manager of the theater, he was the artistic director, and he would choose the plays for any particular season and rehearse their parts with the actors and make sure that everything was done right and turned out well. And the next 5 years we spent in Frankfurt am Main, which I have since visited as a guest and have been treated very well by the city. And then, unfortunately, in 1931, in the summer of 31, we were on vacation on an island off the coast of Germany, and my father came down with a case of appendicitis, which they didn't recognize soon enough, and he died of a ruptured appendix on the operating table in Berlin. And he was operated on, interestingly enough, by a Professor Sauerbruch, who later became Hitler's personal physician. And we never quite sure whether my father would have died anyway. I think he would have, or whether this man didn't do his best. But anyway.
That's an interesting thing to live with. Here your father, who's, I'm sure the doctor knew he was Jewish,
yes,
went on to become Hitler's personal physician. I mean, I guess you never know if he really did his very best to save your father.
Well, my mother and my father's sister, who was a doctor in Berlin and later a doctor in New York, both had their suspicions. But I think they waited 3 days on this island. The doctor on the island thought he was suffering from indigestion and gave him the wrong treatment, and he got sicker and sicker, and by the time they flew him out to Berlin, he was just in terrible pain and was too sick, and they couldn't save him. I think in those days, that's a long time ago, they didn't know all they know about ruptured appendixes as they do today.
Okay, and so then you and your mother moved to Berlin.
We moved.
And you were there in the fall of 31, but you were there as Hitler was taking power. You were a young kid, but you still must have had some perceptions.
Well, I was 9 and a half, and this was now, January 30th, 33, as I remember, Hitler came to power.
That's
but
correct.
Before that, there were a lot of street fighting between the communist youth and the Nazis. And the police just stood there idly with their hands on their baton, on their, that wasn't a baton, it was something, their clubs, and watched it and never did anything. They just watched the Nazis and the communists go at it and beat each other up. And the Weimar Republic was helpless, or it seemed to be. And then there was an election, and the Nazi Party got the majority, and Hitler was named Chancellor by Hindenburg, the old president. And immediately he started his rants on the radio about everything is the fault of the Jews, and we're not going to rest until Germany is free of Jews, Judenrein. And my mother, you asked me about that, my mother and father were so strong social democrats, left-wing social democrats and reformed Jews, and very politically astute. And my father, as I say, had died, but my mother continued that way. And she was working for a publishing house in Berlin called Ullstein Verlag. It's sort of like Simon & Schuster in the United States, Jewish-owned. And within a very short time after Hitler took power, his Minister of the Interior gave orders that all the Jewish owners had to leave, and they put in Aryan managers. And that's what happened to my mother's company. And then within a week, they got their pink slips, and she was fired.
So your mother's Jewish-owned publishing company, the Jews who owned it were thrown out, and then she was thrown out as well.
Correct. Yes.
Now you mentioned in your writings that you were beaten up a few times by Hitler Youth on your way home from school.
Yeah.
What was this like? Were they in uniform?
Yes, some of them were in uniform, like the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. But, you know, it wasn't a severe beating. They would wait for us to come out of school, and then they would say, "Are you Jewish?" And if you said yes, then they said, "Well, then we're going to beat you up." And a few times I came home with a black eye or, you know, bruises and so on, but it was never a dangerous beating. But my mother took notice of that, and I did, and we were beginning to feel that things were heating up and becoming more and more intolerable, particularly in the capital in Berlin. And so one day my mother, I think it was in, gosh, as I remember, probably April 33, came home and she said, "We're not staying here. This country is going in a terrible direction, and we're going to leave." She didn't have a job. She had no income, but she had a pension from my father's work as a municipal employee. And so she said, "We're leaving." And she was 35, a young widow of 35, with a nine-and-a-half-year-old child. And we packed. She packed two big suitcases, and she gave me two little suitcases. And we went to the Hauptbahnhof, you know, the main railroad station. And she took two tickets to Merano in Italy. And the reason she wanted to go there was she was romantic. My father and she had been there on their honeymoon, and she wanted to show that beautiful city to me. And she said, "But we're not staying there. It's just a transition. We're going to Palestine. And I have to wait for a visa to get to Palestine." And so we went to the train station, and I still remember the newspapers with their terrible headlines. They had a couple of Nazi newspapers, the Völkische Beobachter, and a couple of the Angriff, and I don't know what they all were, but they were full of hateful messages about the Jews. And but we had no trouble getting out. You know, in the beginning, it was very easy to get out.
Well, Hitler had only been in power a couple months when you were leaving. Here's a key question. Why was it that your mother was smart enough to get the hell out of there 2 months after Hitler takes power, and so many other Jews didn't leave and wound up in death camps? Why did the Jews not leave?
Well, from what I've heard from talking to many people, of course, now it's the next generation, the adult children, the old children of those people. many had professions like doctors and lawyers and journalists, and many had businesses that they hated to give up. And also, you know, there had been so many changes of government in Germany, so many different prime ministers in the last few years, that the thinking was, well, this guy isn't going to last. He's so outrageous, you know, so crazy in what he is saying and what he's demanding. The German people will never stand for this. And so they thought it would blow over, really. I think that to me is the main reason. And also, you know, to leave, you had to wait for an affidavit from the United States or Britain or wherever you're going, South America. And a guarantee, and then you had to line up a job, and there was quite a bit of effort involved in leaving. I don't know if I've answered your question, but
yeah, you have. So your mother managed to get the papers, and you there were at this time in Germany there were about 50 million Germans and about 500,000 Jews.
Correct.
So the Jews only were about 1% of the population. Most of the Jews who were killed in the death camps were from Poland and from Eastern Europe, but you were a German Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And you made your way with your mother to Palestine.
Right.
And arrived in 1933, I guess. What was it like to be a 10-year-old, 9-10-year-old kid in Palestine back then? Must have been a really amazing experience to be there.
Yeah, well, I didn't speak a word of Hebrew, and that was the first thing I had to learn, because that was the Boeing language in Tel Aviv, where we lived at first. And my mother put me in school, and I think I may have had some private lessons in Hebrew to expedite my learning the language. And she looked for a job. And she had worked in a bank before she married my father. And after that, she helped him with his typing his manuscripts for his poems and his books. He really was a writer by profession in addition to a theater man. And so I lost my track.
That's all right. So you were in schools. Were you only with Jewish children? Was there intermixing of Arab and Jews at the time?
No, in Tel Aviv, they were really in the schools that I went to. There were only Jewish children, right?
But there must have been a majority of Arabs in the or Muslims in the city at the time.
Well, the city, the adjacent city, was Jaffa, J-A-F-F-A, and that was an Arab city, and they had Arab schools. But Tel Aviv was much, much smaller than it is today. It was a flourishing young city, and people were beginning to arrive from Europe. And my mother was thinking about an occupation, and again, she did something very innovative. She brought enough money with her to buy a car, and she became a taxi driver and would pick people up at the train station or at the ships that were coming in from Europe and take them wherever they wanted to go. And then once she got to know the country, then she became a tour guide. And that paid better. And she would meet people at the ship and ask them what they wanted to see. And if they were Christians, they wanted to see the places where Jesus walked, and they wanted to go to Nazareth and Bethlehem and Jerusalem. And if they're Jewish, they were mostly interested in getting this feeling for this land, and also see the holy places, and then finding jobs, going for interviews and things like that.
So was she the first? You say in your document that she was the first female taxi driver in Palestine.
Correct. Yes, I still have a
letter. That's amazing. Was she also the first female tour guide?
Yes, I think so. And then when things got worse in the middle 30s and more dangerous, she continued to drive to all kinds of places that were really very risky. And I didn't know how risky it was, but people paid well to go there, and she took them.
Well, what were the relationships? You had just come from Nazi Germany, where, this tiny minority, 1% of the Jews were incredibly persecuted, worse than at any other time in history. And what was it like being among Arabs in Palestine at this time?
Well, I remember that my mother put me in foster care in a little town called Ramat HaShavim. It was near Petah Tikva. And that place was made up out of 40 Jewish professional families. They were all doctors and lawyers and other professionals. And with the money that they brought out in 33, 34, 35, they bought chicken farms and orange groves and ran those. I mean, they learned how to administer and run them. And the amusing thing about them was they wore jackets because they had been professionals in Germany and Austria. And so the natives called them yekes, which means jackets in Yiddish, I guess.
Sounds like a precursor to yuppies.
Yeah, I guess it might have a connection. I don't know. But
did you experience anti-Semitism from Arabs in Palestine, anything like what you experienced in Germany?
Nothing like that, really, until one thing happened that is sort of indelible in my memory. In this town where we lived, on the borders, the Jews wanted to expand it, and so they bought land from the Arab sheikhs. And the Arab sheikhs were the aristocracy, and they lived on the French Riviera. They lived it up, and when they needed money, they would sell a few hundred acres of land to the Jews. And so then the Jews came with their documents, and there were Arabs there grazing their sheep and their camels and or harvesting dates or something, or whatever, palm trees, coconuts or oranges. And they were absolutely beside themselves that the Jews had documents showing that they now own this land. You no longer own it. We have a legal right. And when the Arabs protested and really objected, the Jews brought in the mandate police, the British police, and they supported the Jews because they had the documents. And that started a lot of trouble, and I remember that I always felt somewhat sorry for the Palestinians because they said, we've been here for 800 years or 1,000 years. What do you mean that we don't own this anymore? We've been here. This is our land. How can they sell it? So.
Well, it's a problem that still hasn't been resolved, isn't it?
No, that's right. It hasn't.
Well, without going into the minefield of Arab-Israeli relations, we're talking with Dr. George Sackheim. He is a 91 years old and has an astonishing history, having been born in Germany and later become a translator at the Nuremberg trials and was an interrogator of German prisoners of war during World War II, and we will get to that after the break. But I want to pursue your personal history. And so you were in Palestine, and then finally your mother, the first female cab driver in Palestine, and the first female tour guide, apparently, sent you to the United States. Now, why did she do that?
Well, she came down with ovarian cancer. And she was still, she died when she was 43 or 44, so she must have been around 40 at the time. And, she had symptoms and pains, and one of her girlfriends was married to a famous surgeon in Jerusalem. I don't remember his name, but she went to Jerusalem to the hospital and was examined, and he said, I have bad news for you, Anuta. You have cancer of the ovaries, and... He knew that she didn't have much money. He said, look, I can do the operation free of charge for you, but you will have to come up with the money for the 2 or 3 weeks in the hospital in convalescent period. And my mother really didn't have it. It was unbelievable, but she didn't have it. And she had no relatives. Her sister-in-law, who lived in Berlin, this doctor, had never been on particularly good terms. And so she didn't want to approach her to borrow the money. And she was just in a very bad way. And so she realized that she only had another year or two to live. And she contacted my aunt, who had moved from Berlin to New York and worked in an old age home in New York City, and told her the facts and said, will you take... My name was Reuben at the time, not George. And will you take Reuben to live with you? Because, I want him to have a home and I want him to have an education. So my aunt said yes. And my aunt sent her the money for the passage. I came on a ship called the SS Conte di Savoia. I think it was in April, 1939.
Now, did you go through Ellis Island when you came to the United States?
No, they didn't have to do that anymore.
No, it was gone. So, by 39, of course, the war clouds were in Europe. You mentioned briefly, by the way, that your mother did encounter some prejudice from Orthodox Jews, who I guess she drove through an Orthodox neighborhood and they threw stones at her car. Was it because she was on, Sabbath?
On Shabbos.
Oh, okay. Shabbat. Okay, so
the
now in New York, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it.
In New York, you went to Columbia University. Well, you went to high school in New York.
I went to David Clinton High School, and I learned English fast enough that I was admitted to the honors school, David Clinton, yet to have an A-minus average or something like that. And from there, I applied to City College and to Columbia in my senior year. I got into both of them, and I was enough of a snob, I'm afraid, that I picked Columbia. Even though, you won't believe this, but it was $15 a credit. So a course was $45, and a program was five courses, so that's what you paid for a college education at an Ivy League school in those days.
Those were the days.
Yeah.
Now, while you were at Columbia, Dr. Sackheim, you were studying, what were you studying?
Well, at first, I wanted to study medicine because my aunt encouraged me to do that, and she said, well, I'm 60, and when you was finished, you can take over my practice and so on. And there I experienced my first failures, really. I first agreed, and the pre-med program is heavy with chemistry and biology and physics, and I took some social science courses too. And I did well in psychology, sociology, economics, and so on. And I did very poorly in the sciences that are based on mathematics. There was just something lacking there. Maybe it was a gene, or maybe...
Well, you're not alone in that.
I got C minuses, and I realized, you know, that with a C minus, I would never get into a medical school. And so I switched majors to psychology. I had a very inspiring psych professor by the name of Fred S. Kellogg at Columbia, and he inspired me to change my major, and I did that.
By March of 1943, the war has broken out, and you were drafted into the U.S. Army.
Correct.
And you were sent to the military intelligence school at Camp Ritchie, Maryland. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. At first for basic training in the infantry in Texas, and they were going to make a medic out of me because they saw that I had a year of pre-med courses. But
obviously you spoke fluent German, fluent English.
Right.
So what were you assigned to do? You were sent back to Europe. That must have been quite an amazing thing for you to be on a ship going back to Europe in the middle of World War II, when you had fled Germany and the Nazis 10 years earlier. What did that feel like?
Well, you know, I felt perfectly safe on those ships, except our convoy was ambushed by submarines. And we got instructions to... the captain was supposed to do all kinds of evasive maneuvers, and the soldiers were pretty scared. So they had three services, Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish. And I went to all three. I was sufficiently scared of the German submarines because we had seen things in the news of the week, you know, of American ships and British ships being sunk. But
were any ships on your convoy actually sunk?
No.
Okay.
I think...
So you arrived back in Europe in April of 1944.
Correct, yes.
Just prior to...
Sent to Camp Litchfield. That's a famous camp. It was a terrible
camp. Where was it?
Camp Litchfield in England.
And you were there just prior to D-Day.
Just a couple of months. And then we were assigned to teams. After graduating from Camp Ritchie, I was made a staff sergeant. These prisoner of war teams usually had a first lieutenant or a captain as the head of it, and then a second lieutenant, and then a master sergeant, a staff sergeant, and a corporal. It was five or six people on the team, and all of them were fluent in either German or Italian at the time, or Japanese and so on.
As well as English. So did you start interrogating German prisoners in England, or did that wait until you went on to the continent?
That waited until I got to the continent.
And when did you arrive on the continent of Europe?
On D+7. I have that here in my notes. Actually.
So you went in on June... D-Day was June 5th, I believe, right? Or June 6th?
Yeah, I came on June the 12th.
Into Europe, as
into France, into Normandy.
You went into Normandy?
On D+12, yes. Oh, yeah, I was in on the invasion, although it was a little bit later. Oh, let's see, here I have my notes. During the war, I served in the U.S. Army as a member of a prisoner of war interrogation team, which was attached to the 104th Infantry Division. We arrived in Normandy, France, from England on June the 13th, 1944, D+7, and were in combat constantly until early May 45, when we linked up with the Russians in Delitzsch near Leipzig in East Germany and Saxony.
So you were attached to military units, and your basic job was to interrogate German prisoners of war. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Wow. And, my sole real contact with D-Day is having seen Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan, and shown those first 20 minutes to many of my classes. And I got to say, I mean, you must have seen quite a bit of the carnage, or at least the aftermath, as you came into Normandy.
Yes, we did. We were very, very lucky that we avoided the first week. And they had removed most of the dead bodies from the beaches, and we climbed the cliffs and went up top and hid in the forest. And they could still reach us with their 88-millimeter guns and were shooting at us. But we were driving forward and doing a good job of it.
Wow. We are talking with Dr. George Sackheim. He has gotten us now from Nazi Germany and the rise of Adolf Hitler through Palestine to the United States, Columbia University, and now we're back in Normandy 1 week after the invasion. Astonishing history from a 91-year-old veteran. Dr. Sackheim, we're going to take a short break.
Sure.
Listen to the Solartopia song. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes if you need to stretch. And we're going to go now and talk personally to Hermann Göring and Rudolf Hess, the commandant of Auschwitz. Thank you so much, Dr. Sackheim. Stick with us, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia.
Okay, we are back, and I think, can you hear me on the Skype here? Okay, George, we usually have a gremlin or two. We're with Dr. George Sackheim, talking to us about his incredible experiences as an interpreter and cross-examiner, I guess, interrogator of German war prisoners immediately after D-Day. Dr. Sackheim, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Good. Okay. So after the obligatory technical glitch here, we wanted you are 21 years old.
22 years.
You were born in Germany, you lived in Palestine, you came to the United States, went to Columbia University, and then shipped out with the U.S. Army as part of Army intelligence to go back to Germany. You arrive back to Europe. You arrive in France 1 week after D-Day, and your unit begins interrogating German prisoners. Do I have that right?
You have it right, yes.
So tell us now, what was it like interrogating German prisoners of war in the middle of the D-Day invasion?
Well, I'll just tell you one brief vignette, but I want to tell you about how we liberated a concentration camp and then go on to Göring and Hess. When we arrived, they had captured thousands of German prisoners already, the Americans had, and they were in a big camp. And we were brought in, about a half a dozen of our teams, and we set up tables. And what they wanted to know is where the V-1 and the V-2 were being made.
These are the missiles that Hitler was going to use to bombard England.
And he did. They were bombarding England even while we were there. I experienced some of it during my 1 week in London. But that's what they wanted to know. Where are they being manufactured? And we were a little naive, and we asked them, in German, I'm translating it, have you seen the V-1, or did you see the V-2? And they said, yes, of course, we saw them. We saw them flying overhead towards England, and the Führer promised us that that is his secret weapon, and that's going to defeat the British, and we're going to destroy England, and then we will invade, and so on. And they acted like they didn't understand us, and so after a while we had to change our questioning, and instead of asking whether they saw them, we said, what did you do war work before you were drafted, and have you ever worked on guided missiles and so on? And eventually we did get a few cooperative people who told us something.
Now, you said that, if I understood you right, you told me that the prisoners kind of broke down into three categories.
Yes.
You actually had people in the journal. Well, tell us about that.
Okay. Well, broadly, I have written about this. The prisoners broke down into three categories. One category were people who were always anti-Nazis. They had been social democrats, liberals, Catholics, people who really had no use for Hitler and the Nazis. And they were quite willing, when captured, to tell us whatever, answer whatever questions we had.
Yet they had these views, but they were still in the German army.
Oh, they were in the German army. They wore German army uniforms. But when we asked them questions, they were cooperative. They answered them. Then there was a very large group of people who were followers. And as long as Hitler was doing well for Germany, and Germany was prosperous and winning everywhere, they were with the Führer. They supported him. But now he said we would never land in Normandy, and we would never certainly get as far as we were by then. They began to have their doubts, and many of them started to answer our questions and tell us what we wanted to know. And then there was a third group, and they were mostly SS officers and men in their special uniforms, who said, oh, according to the Geneva Convention, we don't have to tell you anything except our name, rank, and serial number, and we're not going to betray our country or our Führer, and we're not going to tell you anything. You can do with us what you want. And that was the third group.
Okay, and you did this for a year, basically, from June of 44 until May of 45, interrogating these prisoners.
These prisoners, right, yes.
And then you volunteered, and this is you are just such a rare, if not unique, person at this point in time. You became an interpreter at the Nuremberg trials.
Yes.
In which the Nazi leadership, what was left of it, what could be found, was put on trial for their war crimes. Can you tell us about this?
Okay, then you want me not to take the time to talk about liberating a concentration camp.
We'll do that. Yes, tell us a bit about that. You should fill that in. So because you came to Nuremberg, of course, with a unique experience of having gone to Nordhausen.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, on April 12th, 1945, my unit liberated the Nordhausen concentration camp in the Harz Mountains. The scenes we encountered there were absolutely horrific. When the inmates had no longer been able to work in the tunnels in the mountains where the guided missiles were being produced, then some 20,000 Jewish, Polish, French, Russian, and other V2 factory workers were simply starved or tortured and shot and then burned to death in cold blood by the SS guards. We saw pathetic figures looking like skeletons coming toward us, begging us for food and medicine. And the dead were lying in rows, and there were piles of body that the SS didn't have a chance to dispose of before we advanced so fast that they just fled. And they were waiting to be burned, and they never did it. And the smell of decay and burning stung our nostrils. So in the afternoon of the day the camp was captured, our commanding general, whose name was Terry Allen, called up General Eisenhower and asked him to come and see this outrage for himself, which was hard to believe. Dwight Eisenhower arrived soon after by helicopter, and the two generals walked through and inspected the camp. And then I gave orders that the whole male population of the nearby town of Nordhausen had to walk through the camp and see for themselves what had happened here, so that they could never say these events had not occurred and were atrocities invented by the Allies. Then the Germans were ordered to clean up the camp and give the piled of corpses a decent burial. So if you want to understand why it was necessary for us to fight the Nazis, in addition to their intention to rule the world, it was this kind of total inhumanity and cruelty practiced by them in their concentration camps in Germany and Poland, which made it mandatory. So I have absolutely no question about World War II, even though I live among very peace-loving Quakers here who think, have all these stickers on their cars that war is not the answer, war is unnecessary, and so on.
Well, then you wound up after this astonishing experience, which I'm sure at the age of 21 or 2 was... you became an interpreter at the Nuremberg trials, and you spent a full day interpreting the testimony of Hermann Göring, who was the number two, certainly a driving force in the Nazi insanity. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. He was a very powerfully built man. Deep, watery blue eyes, which struck the observer every once in a while with a piercing, penetrating glance. His face looked pale and drawn with pink spots on his cheeks. He had deep circles under his eyes and generally gave the impression of being an extremely tired or exhausted man. He had thick, powerful hands with short fingers, and he would emphasize his points with sweeping gestures of both arms or by spreading his fingers and banging on the table with his fingertips. He frequently supported his substantial weight by leaning on his clenched fist and elbow. On one occasion, this observer I surprised him in the act of picking his nose. However, when he saw me looking at him and smiled, he ceased immediately and scowled at me. His facial expression was hardly ever at rest. He was very animated, smiled frequently, decidedly dominated the entire scene during the interview, including the interrogator, who was an American colonel. I was glad that he was being guarded by two military policemen and that I was seated on the opposite side of the table from him. Justice Jackson, our chief, described him as an arrogant and contemptuous man. Now, the focus of his interrogation was the Battle of Britain from a military point of view. He clearly had superior knowledge of this subject matter. His choice of language was strong, relevant, descriptive, and full of flavor, just like his speeches. Here are a few typical quotations. The assistant interviewer was a Hungarian who was an expert. And he said, "May I ask you a personal question?" Göring said, noncommittally, "Bitte," which means please. "Mr. Yari, a Reich Marshal, did you yourself ever fly over England?" Göring, "In diesem Krieg nicht," which means not in this war. We all smiled because we knew that Göring had been a famous flying ace in World War I and had flown over England many times. Now, he offered this very interesting bit of information to us. And this is my English translation from the German. He said, "I told him, Hitler, many times, time and time again, that we must destroy the English war industry instead of wasting our bombs by dropping them on that stupid London. What good would it do us if a few hundred or a few thousand more houses go up in flames? It's a total waste of time." Next, he was asked for the reasons for the attack on Bath, which was not a fortified city and no industry. Göring answered that that was done directly on Hitler's orders to harass the British government. "I want you to attack Bath immediately," he said to him. He said Hitler had such a powerful personality and such a magnetic personality. When he barked out or yelled out an order, there was no way to not obey it. He did that at the risk of your life. So,
but Göring was powerful himself.
Yes.
And he seemed, if I read you correctly in my own study of his history, he seemed almost proud of the atrocities that he committed. Is that an accurate
That's right. He had no regrets. He tried to keep all the prisoners in line and to intimidate them so they wouldn't give speeches in court and so they wouldn't cooperate with us or tell us anything. He really, really tried to hold his group together.
And the same with Rudolf Hess, the commander of Auschwitz. Did he show any regret at all about what he did?
No, you know, not until the very end. I'd like to really give you something about Hess because it was so unusual. Here's what Hess said, and this is the direct quote from his confession. "In the year of 1944, the Führer decided that the Jewish question now had to be solved once and for all. He informed Himmler, the Reichsführer of the SS, of his decision. Himmler then ordered Höss to come to Berlin from Auschwitz and told him, among other things, if we do not exterminate the Jewish race completely and totally, the Jewish race will destroy the German people. In psychoanalysis and psychology, we call this a projection mechanism, you know, where you just reverse things completely, blaming the Jews for the intentions of the Nazis. Himmler then directed me, he said, to expand and extend the gas chambers and crematoria at Auschwitz. This was clearly an illegal order, but not according to Nazi practices at that time. I then returned to Auschwitz and had additional gas chambers constructed, each of which could contain 2,000 people, as well as the crematoria for burning their remains. The gold was extracted from their teeth after they were gassed, just before their bodies were burned. In order that the prisoners did not know until the last moment what was going to be done to them, we placed signs at the entrance to the gas chambers which read, to delousing, for disinfection, to the baths.
And this is your translation of, that, of what he was saying?
Yeah, of what
you
was saying.
You sat in the Nuremberg trial and you heard him say this.
I heard him say this.
And you translated his German into English.
That's correct, yes.
My and God. Then, and then what did he... What did he finally say? What were his last words?
Well, what he said is... I'll give you a little more about the process and then his last words. Do we have time for that?
Yes, we have 8 minutes left.
Okay, well, I'll try to do it in three or four. Höss explained to the court in a calm, apathetic, factual tone how it was possible to kill 10,000 people in a 24-hour period. I quote from his confession at the Nuremberg trials. Technically, that wasn't so hard. It would not have been hard to exterminate even greater numbers. The killing itself took the least time. You could dispose of 2,000 head in half an hour, but it was the burning that took all the time. The killing was easy. You didn't even need guards to drive them into the chambers. They just went in expecting to take showers, and instead we turned on the poison gas. The whole thing went very quickly. We were required to carry out these exterminations in secrecy, but of course the foul and nauseating stench from the continuous burning of the bodies permeated the entire area, and all of the people living in the surrounding communities knew that exterminations were going on at Auschwitz, and so on and so forth. Now, they had requested that they shoot the people, but that was not granted. They didn't have enough bullets. They needed the bullets for the war. So, a little more about Höss. During the interrogation, I was very much aware of the fact that I was sitting in the same room with a mass murderer. Through the years, many people have asked me how one develops a psychopathic personality and can carry out orders like Höss. I don't know the answer, but Major Gilbert, the Nuremberg prison psychologist, came up with one reply, which I will offer you for your consideration. Dr. Gilbert was astonished by Höss's apathy and matter-of-factness, and he questioned him several times in an effort to understand his indifference. And here's the answer to your question. Höss responded, "Don't you see, we SS men were not supposed to think about these things. It never occurred to us. Besides, it was something already taken for granted that the Jews were to blame for everything. It was not just newspapers like the Stürmer, but it was everything we ever heard. Even our military and ideological training took for granted that we had to protect Germany from the Jews. We were all so trained to obey orders without even thinking that the thought of disobeying an order would never have occurred to anybody." And so I have a lot more, but I'm going to stop on Höss. You get the picture what kind of a person this was. He was tried a second time after the war by the Poles and sentenced to death by hanging, and they hung him in right next to his residence in Auschwitz.
But you, what he said, the quote you just read, you translated from him.
Yes,
directly.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
God. Okay. Dr. Sackheim, I'm going to have to ask you if you can, to make time to come back for another half hour. I mean, you are such a, at another point with, at your convenience. Because
yes.
We need to discuss this in depth. I mean, you are 91 years old. You directly heard these guys say these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you translated their words. It's mm-hmm. You know, it's staggering to me to hear these things said. And it must have been staggering to you to translate them at the time. I mean, what kind of impact this must have had on you at the age of 22, 23 years
22.
Old?
Well, you know, I was stunned and shocked, but I had a job to do and translated it to the best of my ability. And then the next day we got the transcript back from the court reporter who worked on a machine. I don't know what that machine is, but she was... It looked like a little typewriter, and she was amazing. She just typed everything and then gave it back to us for review. The colonel, who was the interrogator and the interpreter, and any witness who was there were asked to review it, and then he signed it. You know, he signed all these papers that they were accurate.
He did. Hess yeah. signed it.
Oh, yes. I have, you know, we have the signature that that these were not forced confessions, you know, they weren't extracted from him by torture or anything like that.
God. Dr. George Sackheim, I am going to, you know, I will communicate with you off the show, and we'll see if we can get you back for another half hour. This is just, this is staggering stuff to me, and I'm sure to some of our listeners at any rate. Is there a place where they can go online to see your speech? Do you know offhand?
Yes, there is. Well,
you know, you'll have to give it to me probably in the next show. Do you have it in front of you?
No, I don't have it in front of me, but you can find it under George Sackheim, Holocaust Survivor, and...
Just Google it. S-A-K-H-E-I-M. George
yeah.
Sackheim.
Holocaust Survivor, and there is a more detailed report about my life.
Okay, well, if you don't mind, I will invite you back for another half hour. I'm just staggered by to hear this straight from someone who was there and who actually took down this translation. So we're almost out of time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank the crew in New York. Dr. Sackheim, you are an astonishing human being, and it's been an honor to talk to you. And I want to get into the morality and a little more,
oh, yeah, sure.
a broader picture yeah. of this. So we will have another half hour for you whenever you want to have it. This has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We'll be back again with Dr. Sackheim and with so much else in the coming shows. Thank you, crew in New York. And again, for a better world. We'll have more discussion on this, and we'll see you again next week. Thank you.
And that'll be Solartopia.